let us get started. So the learning this week is sponsored by Janine Nussbaum in absentia. And it's for the yahrzeit of her father, Dr. Julius Kuhl, Rabbi Chiel ben Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac, Olav HaShalom, Neshama Shav and Aliyah. We are in the sixth parak, chapter 6. It's page 1849 in the Stone Tanakh. This is the middle of attempt number 3 on Nehemiah, right? The first attempt on Nehemiah was the lure, sending him letters saying we should go meet, and the idea in the letter from Sanballat to Nehemiah that we should go meet is really an attempt to either lure him into a trap where he will be killed, or one other way to read it, lure him out of the city, and then as a result they'll be able to attack the wall and attack the things he's been working on with him away, and hopefully people will be in disarray. So that's the first attempt. Nehemiah ignores he doesn't ignore the letters, he dismisses the letters. He says, thank you very much, sorry, really busy, can't go. So then he gets a fifth letter from Sanballat, and this is the open letter, serving as a form of blackmail, in which the report is, you know, people are saying, we've heard people say, you know, inevitably, when someone says to you, numerous people have told me, or a number of people have told me, you have to remind yourself that zero is a number also. When someone says that, it isn't necessarily true. But he says, I'm hearing the buzz around town that you are planning to become the king, that it's being said in the streets, and maybe this is a plot that you are concocting, that once you have the wall complete, you're going to declare yourself to be the king, and I just want to help you. Let us, as we said, take counsel together. And the fact that it's sent as an open letter makes Nehemiah vulnerable. I should note as well, I didn't mention this last time, but I think it's worth realizing, the cleverness of this plot, because in the previous chapter, as a result of the assaults on the wall, right, the attempt by the Samaritans to attack, what did Nehemiah do? He set up guards on the wall, and worked at reinforcing the wall. So what that means is, Nehemiah, to defend himself against the attackers, has now done exactly what they turn into evidence of his revolt. Why is Nehemiah posting guards on the wall? Why is Nehemiah reinforcing the wall's defenses? Because he anticipates an attack, because he's going to declare himself king. That's the cleverness of the second approach. And Nehemiah, again, is not impressed. He says, no such thing, and attempt number 2 falls apart. That led to attempt number 3. And in attempt number 3, Nehemiah actually goes to Shemaiah, and that's on page 1849. It started in Pasuk Yud. We read the beginning of it last time. Nehemiah goes to this fellow by the name of Shemaiah and gets a warning. Shemaiah says to him that the attackers are coming to kill him tonight. And therefore he should go into the Heichal, he should go into the sanctuary, we will confer there together, but close the doors, and that way you will be safe. And we said that Nehemiah goes to him for one of two reasons. The basic read is, why does Nehemiah go to Shemaiah? What's the basic read?
The basic read is
Nehemiah thinks he's a false prophet, and he wants to silence him, because the stuff he's saying about Nehemiah is dangerous. He is one of the people who Sanballat has hired. Malvin, though, says what Rebecca is saying, that actually there's a second element here. That Nehemiah is wondering, you know, maybe I will be king. Maybe this is for real. Remember that Nevuah prophecy exists as of the time of Malachi, which is either this time or slightly earlier than this. Maybe this is another true Navi, it's a true prophecy, and therefore there's something to see here. But this fellow Shemaiah is stuck at home. We talked about why he's stuck at home, that was last week's discussion. And so Nehemiah goes to him. And Shemaiah says, you should hide in the Heichal. So what exactly does it mean that you should hide in the Heichal? What is it that Shemaiah is trying to get Nehemiah to do that will be destructive to him? So Rashi says that he wants to give Nehemiah a reputation as a hypocrite and a sinner. That he doesn't belong in the Heichal. And by locking himself into the Heichal, he will have demonstrated that he doesn't take Jewish law seriously. That's Rashi's approach, Mitzudat David as well. Make Nehemiah sin, expose him to everybody as a phony. Second approach, he wants to frighten Nehemiah and get them to stop working on the wall. Also a suggestion of Rashi. Third approach from Ibn Ezra is simply give Nehemiah a reputation as a coward. If people see that Nehemiah turns tail, right, that he's hiding in the temple, they will not be confident that in his leadership. Remember, one of the big things that Nehemiah has accomplished here is that he's taken people who are a minority, who are a weak minority, and bolstered their confidence such that they think they can fend off the Samaritans. But what happens when your leader and the source of your confidence himself goes and hides? At that point, people lose faith. So that's Ibn Ezra's approach. The Dot Mikra takes that approach as well. Then Rabbi Zakheim offers the idea that it's actually meant to make people believe the allegations about Nehemiah are true. In other words, if Nehemiah is hiding in the sanctuary, it must be because there is some reason for people to attack him. He really is plotting a rebellion. And then one last note, which is, again, based on the Malbim's idea that Nehemiah is checking out this false prophet to make people think that the prophet is actually allied with Nehemiah. Because if the prophet says to him, go into the Heichal, and we're going to confer there, and that's what they go ahead and do, people will really believe this prophet, who is telling everybody Nehemiah is going to be king, is part of Nehemiah's plan. Well, Nehemiah responds and says, do I look like somebody who runs away? I don't think so. That's his first point. And then his second point is, and this is where we'll pick up in the text, so chapter 6, sentence 11, he says, in addition to saying, Haish Kamoni Yivrach, a man like me run away, he also says, Umi Chamoni Asher Yavo Al HaHechal V'chai. He says, who, like me, would come into the sanctuary and live? Lo avo, I ain't going. So there we saw two explanations, right? One explanation is the literal, to say, I'm not allowed in, I'm not a Kohen. However, we noted from the Meshech Chachma, or Meir Simcha Kohen of Divinsk, that the Torah doesn't prohibit him from entering. Yisrael, a non-Kohen, can go into the Heichal when he brings a karban. There's no death penalty for him to do that. So his answer is that what he's saying is, do you really think I would go there in order to survive? For all the other reasons given. I don't want to look like a coward. I don't want to look like I'm an ally of yours. I don't want to look like I actually have been plotting, and so on. So Nehemiah, yeah.
Has the concept of a religious house as sanctuary come into being as of this time?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That goes back to biblical times, meaning Chumash. The Torah warns regarding somebody who commits murder, Me'im mizbechi tikachenu lamut, take him even away from the altar. And in the Navi, we find cases, Yoav, for example, of somebody who runs into the sanctuary and says, now I'll be safe here. Yes, absolutely.
But he cannot be killed in the sanctuary.
Well, because he thinks he can't be killed in the sanctuary. The answer may be, we can take you anywhere we want. Me'im mizbechi tikachenu lamut. Right, it's not going to help him.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So that I don't know. I would be surprised if it was just us, but I don't know. Yeah. It sounds more like to me when the Torah has to say taken away even from the altar. It sounds like there may have been another culture in which they said that actually is sanctuary, and the Torah is saying not for us. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to find that it's some kind of idea in other cultures, and Hashem is saying that's not the way we do things. In the same way that we're told that lo sikhu kofar lanefesh rotzeach, if someone commits murder, you're not allowed to accept a ransom payment. There were cultures in which you could accept a ransom payment, and the Torah is saying, again, we don't work that way. So, yeah, there were and there are. True. Okay. So Nehemiah comes to the realization that this is a false prophet, right? In Pasuk Yud Bet, sentence 12, he says, Va'akira, I recognize, v'hine lo elokim shalacho, God did not send Shemaiah, ki anuvuazi ber alai, v'toviyah v'sanvalatzcharo, he was speaking about me, hired by Toviyah and Sanbalat. So how does he know that this is a lie? How does he know that this is a trap? So we saw Zakheim simply said the plot's too obvious. trying to lure him into the Beis HaMikdash is too obvious. Maybe. Rashi said, it's in source number one on the sheet, this is the last thing that we said last time, I recognize from his words that God had not sent him with this, for me to sin because I'm afraid of dying. Meaning, what Rashi is arguing is, God wouldn't tell me to violate a prohibition even to save my life. Now, I find that surprising, because of course we do say that. You do violate prohibitions to save your life, right? Other than the big three, Chil Hashem, whatever, we do say that. But that's what Rashi says. Malbim offers another explanation. Again, Malbim is, yeah.
No, I'm just thinking, and he was giving that logic, and Eliyahu was told to go and sacrifice on Carmel, which
right.
is God telling him to do something.
Yeah, so it certainly happens.
Yes.
I'm not clear on that. I think what Rashi might be saying is what we're going to see in Mitzvot David shortly. I think that's where he's going. But Malbim, again, reads this as part of the bigger picture. Malbim's whole theme in this section is to combine the vision of Nehemiah will be king with the statement of they're coming to attack you tonight, you better hide in the sanctuary. So Malbim says the two are hand in hand. Take a look at source number two. V'zehi kir ata, he recognized this now. Mipnei shaha etza sheya atzlo ata, so seres el anevuah shenivei alav kodem, because the prophecy he's getting now contradicts the prophecy from beforehand, meaning that you're going to be king. She'im Hashem diber she'yeh melech al Yisrael, if God is going to say he's going to be the king over Israel, Eich yuchu lo oivav lahargo, she'ischabei b'nehem al haichal, how could the enemy win such that he's now going to have to hide in the sanctuary to prevent his own death? You said I'm going to be king. Behefech, just the opposite. Haya lo lo mar lo, the vision should have been, al tira ki dvar Hashem lo yashuv reikam umaloch timloch. Your enemy is coming, don't worry about it, you're going to be fine.
Did Shemaiah realize that? That he's giving him two different messages that are conflicting each other?
Good question. I think you could probably answer that.
So you think that he's saying, you know, wouldn't he be aware of the fact that he's contradicting himself?
Possibly, but I again, you know, maybe I'm just too 21st century, but I feel like there are pragmatic statements made by prophets as well. And, you know, when you think of the story with Shmuel, right? Shmuel is told to go coronate David, and he's afraid to do so, and he says, I don't want to tell him, I don't want to tell Shaul where I'm going, and God says, all right, you know, tell him you're bringing a carbon, right? There is such an idea as the prophet needs to run away. The prophet needs to safeguard himself, even though he's on a mission from God. To borrow a phrase. So maybe that's what maybe that's what's going on here. I understand Malbim's point, but I'm not so sure that it's that compelling. I think that it could have been legit, saying you're going to be king. Number one, and number two, your life is in danger. So for now, go into the Beis HaMikdash. I'm not so sold on this point. But Mitzvot David takes it a little more directly, and again, this could be what Rashi meant as well. Source number three. Harbei revach v'hatzala lefanav. Umadua im kein yitzaveh la'avor mitzvaso. He says, there are so many ways that God can save people from harm. Why would he tell me to violate the Torah in order to save my life? Ki im amro midato, haya makom lomar mibnei pikuach nefesh utara davar. If he were speaking on his own, if this were Shmaya's personal sentence of, you know, my prophecy was you're going to be king, my personal advice is go into hiding because you're going to get attacked. So then I would say, yeah, he's saying this because, presumably, you do that to save your life. You violate the law, like we said, pikuach nefesh. But that's not something that God is going to command. The statement of go hide to save your life wouldn't be a nevuah. That's Mitzvot David's argument. If God is concerned about saving my life, he's going to find some other way to do it. And maybe, again, maybe that's what Rashi meant. This is consistent with something we talked about way back when. In Ezra. Remember we talked about multiple times when Ezra did what we would view as a haras shah, a ruling for the moment. he said, you know what, we need to bring this karban now, or this number of karbanot now. And we said he had a reason for doing so. What we said at the time was, Haras Shah, this special dispensation, is only given in the event that there is cause. In the event that there's a particular reason to issue such a ruling. And here, there really is no need. There's no need for him to do so. Moshe.
This may be off on a tangent, but I'm just trying to understand something. And not to be controversial.
Yeah.
Is there any reason why the paratroopers overran Harbite?
Yes.
Was there an halakhic issue with that? I've never heard that there was. I'm just
seeing
there might have been.
Right. I mean, it's an interesting question. Moshe asks the question, is there some kind of concern for violating Jewish law by going on Har HaBayit as part of liberating it, effectively? So the straightforward answer is, you're prosecuting a war. And in prosecuting a war, for the safety of the nation, you need to go up there, you go up there. That would be the straightforward answer. It's funny though, because it's in Toronto Torah this week, you know, we've been doing all year columns on, you know, celebrating Israel's 70th year. So one of the columns this week is about the status quo letter. So the status quo letter was back at the founding of the state. It actually was just before the founding of the state, 1947. It was Ben Gurion's letter, in which he agreed that the state will continue to function in a religious way. Shabbos will be the day of rest. Weddings will be done according to halacha. Public kitchens, government-run, you know, institutional kitchens will be kosher. That was his letter, and the motivation for it is the UN was at the time the UN had created a commission to analyze whether to create two states or one state, and Ben Gurion was afraid that there were those within the observant community who would be opposed to the founding of a state, who would say that this state is going to be secular, better not to have a state at all than to create a state in which halacha will not be observed. He did not want any voices like that coming from the Jewish community when the UN is coming to speak to people and figure out what they want to do. So he writes this letter as a means of essentially conciliating with those who would otherwise oppose him. And that letter, of course, becomes the foundation for everything that has happened in the last 70 years. I don't think Gurion realized what he was doing. But in terms of your question, there were those in the halachic community who said better not to have a state if having a state is going to mean these sorts of problems, these sorts of halachic problems. So, you know, that's essentially the question is, am I allowed to take back Har HaBayit if it means we have to go up on Har HaBayit, and the Rambam has says that it retains its Kedusha and so forth.
I've never seen anywhere.
Nope.
Anywhere that the question was asked, obviously we're not going to ask. Well, the chief rabbi is not going to call us. Tell us what to do.
Well, the question wasn't going to be asked because it was all a surprise. And after the fact, you don't bother to write about it.
Oh, but they waited on the hill for a few hours before they went in.
Yeah, and at that point, someone was going to ask the Shaila for those few hours. No. Generally speaking, you don't write a tshuva about something that's already taken place. It's an interesting question in and of itself, but yeah. Okay. So, Nehemiah has decided that Shemaya is a liar, right? Whether it's because he sees through the plot, whether it's because God wouldn't have told me to do this, he says Shemaya is a liar, and he says, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Leman Sahur Hu, which is a hard set of words to translate. They translate it here as, it was because he was a hireling. He did this because he was hired to do so. Leman Irava Esekein V'chatas, he said, I would be afraid, I would follow his advice, and I would, again, sin or be seen to be a coward, and so on. But if you take a look on your sheet of number 4, Malbim, again, consistent with his thought on this entire section, says, Leman Sachur Hu, the point of this was, Leman Ya'alilu Bazeh Al Nechem, so that Malbim says that it was, the point was to get people to say that Shemaya had been hired by Nehemiah. That's, again, this is just Malbim's philosophy in this whole section, that the goal of the plot is to make people think that Nehemiah has actually been hiring people to promote himself. So that's your third plot. Ralbag notes something important here in source number 5. In his summary of the lessons you can learn, he writes, She'ein ra'oi la'adam she'yamin bekalut hadvarim ha'mesuparim lo, ba'ofen she'yiniyehu zelasos ma'she'ef sh'shiyeh bo'lo nezek ma'gufi o'nafshi. He says, you can't believe swiftly that which people tell you such that it moves you to do something that is to your own detriment, physically or spiritually. That's the lesson you're supposed to take here. Meaning, Nehemiah doesn't let them panic him. And even if the person telling him this says to him, well, this is a prophecy, when the words themselves testify that it's not so. So the point that Ralbag makes is this is meant to be a lesson in general, and it's the theme of the chapter on the whole. God is going to help, but he expects you to make major contributions. That's Nehemiah's philosophy. Right, Nehemiah does not wait for God to take care of it. Nehemiah is going to do it himself. Well, for sure, that's a piece of what puts him in this situation. But
he sort of decides to grow into himself instead of relying purely.
Right, but Ezra didn't have Nevuah, and yet we didn't see him take charge of everything. Right? No, it's not. I mean, Ezra does not appear in this narrative yet. Oh, he's showing up in Parakhet.
But is he?
He's physically here, as far as we can tell. Again, assuming you don't do a radical rewrite of the book to put Nehemiah early on, Ezra is here, and Nehemiah either doesn't need him at this stage, Nehemiah is taking care of practical details and not having a conversation with him, or Nehemiah is writing him out of the story. But I have a hard time with that idea.
Yeah.
I have a hard time with that idea, because if Nehemiah wanted to write him out of the story, he wouldn't feature him in Parakhet the way he's going to. So I don't view it as Nehemiah writing him out of the story. I think it's just that he's not involved. This isn't what Ezra does. Ezra's not a builder of walls. Ezra is not a setter of guard shifts. Ezra is somebody who, when word comes that people have intermarried, says, this is terrible, we have to call a fast. Right? That's what Ezra does. Okay. Fair. Not all the way through. Not all the way through, but yes. In the earlier years.
Well, that pre-walked in as well.
No. I mean, they joined. They ultimately, right. Well, the Atalena was right. Okay. Psukim Yadalad and Tetvav, 14 and 15. Nehemiah's prayer. So Nehemiah says, Zochra Elokai Letovia Ulasanvalat Kemasav Ela. God, you should remember for Tovia and Sanbalat, like these deeds that he did, meaning that Sanbalat did, it appears, even though Tovia is mentioned here. Vegam Lenoadya Hanviah Ulyeser Hanviim Asher Hayum Yareim OC, as well as for Noadia the what? Prophetess. Female prophet. Right? That's a headliner.
We have seven.
We do. And Noadiah is not on the list for some strange reason. Remember for Noadiah the prophetess and the rest of the prophets, Asher Hayumi are MOC, who are intimidating me. That is his prayer. And then he says, Vatishlam hachoma be'esrim v'chamisha le'elul. On the 25th day of Elul, the wall was completed, l'chamishim u'shnayim yom, after 52 days. What's odd here?
That you go from one idea to the other.
What do you mean?
Isn't it strange that he goes from all these his enemies, we'll say, and then he finishes with the wall? Like, it seems like a strange.
Right.
You go from one to the other.
That would be maybe, or you could look at it as
vindication.
Vindication, right? This is a valedictory speech.
Right.
This is, they tried to stop me and they couldn't do it, we finished the wall. Right? And he invokes God, right? God, remember them. Remember all those things they tried to do in order to stop me. It's interesting that Geshem dropped out. Right? Geshem was in the first plot in the chapter. But I'm guessing that the reason why Geshem is omitted is because that's not the premier plot that he's concerned with. The Geshem's plot didn't matter, essentially. It was just, hey, let's send letters and tell him, and tell him that he should come out and speak to us, and we'll get him out of the city. That's small potatoes. What do you mean? I think that he's just saying the first plot doesn't matter to him. The later plots matter. The ones where people are going to be saying, look, Nehemiah's trying to make himself king, those plots have teeth. So Geshem's plot doesn't matter, and therefore Geshem is omitted. But who is Noadiah? Who is Noadiah the prophetess? Where did that come from? No, we do not know anyone named Noadiah. So Rashi says that Noadiah is just one of those paid off prophets. Not the same as Shemaiah, somebody else. Ibn Ezra, the Otzer Midrashim, suggests that actually this is Shemaiah. Although Ibn Ezra backs out of the idea, but first say it could be Shemaiah because the word Noadiah, look back, I know everyone's jumping to Koheles, hang on. But just take a look very quickly back at Pasuk Yud, sentence 10. Shemaiah said, Niva'ed, El Beis Elokim, Nun Vav Ayin Dalid, Noadiah, Niva'ed. So maybe that's the reference. However, others say no. This is actually a woman named Noadiah, and Ibn Ezra floats that idea. It's clearly then not Shemaiah. And then he notes you this pasuk, which I just couldn't resist noting. You now see it. Kohelet chapter 7, sentence 27. What's the page number? 1740. I sort of feel bad about making you flip the pages to get there. But I note for you there, what does it say? The keywords, two keywords in the Hebrew. Amrah Kohelet. Right?
The female.
Amrah Kohelet. Kohelet said in the feminine. So Ibn Ezra says sometimes a man can be given a female verb. Don't get hung up on it. The other idea, he mentions two ideas. He says it could be. He ends up saying that it's female and this is more likely, he says. So Noadiah seems to be a prophetess who is in that group that Sanballat hires to go around talking about Nehemiah. And they finish the wall after 52 days. So the general approach is that means 52 days from the start. Right? If you work backwards, in terms of when Nehemiah showed up, we said he showed up at the beginning of the month of Av, and you get 52 days, and it's the 25th of Elul now. And the math is nice. It takes 3 days for him to do his original reconnaissance of the wall, then he starts, and you ended up at the 25th of Elul. It happens to also be a really good day to finish the wall. What's the 25th day of Elul on our calendar?
Creation,
right? Meaning, it's not quite creation. It's good enough. It's the week of creation. It's creation week, meaning if day six is the first day of Tishrei and you assume 29 days in Elul, why not assume that? That's the way our calendar is set up. Then the 29th day is day 5. 28th day is day 4. 27th day is day 3. 26th day is day 2. No, 25th day is day 1. That actually does work. The 25th day, right, because in Chagai we had at one point the Nevuah on the 24th day. We said it was the day before everything starts, and that was the day before they start building. So actually it does work well here. The 25th day of Elul is day 1 of creation, and that makes this a nice sort of moment of theater, if you will. The wall of Yerushalayim is complete on the day that we started to create the world. God starts to create the world. It's actually the day. That was the plan from the start. Ibn Ezra has a different view about the 52 days. He does not believe that it took them 52 days to build the wall. He thinks that you build the wall over a much longer period of time. Yeah, it certainly felt like it. I mean, it took us 52 days to learn it. So Ibn Ezra in source number 7 says no. L'chamishim u'shnayim yom sheshalach Sanballat ha'igeret. I assume the aleph is just a typo in the either in some printer or even in my Bar Ilan. It's meant to be Sanballat. But it's 52 days from when Sanballat sent his letter in the beginning of this chapter. Okay. Either way, don't assume that because your wall is built, everything is okay. It doesn't work that way. And so we continue with the end of this paragraph. Psukim Tet Zayin Tiyotes. Okay, we are again on page 1849. The plots continue. Vayi kasher shamu kol oyveinu. Our enemies all heard this. Vayiru kol hagoyim asher svivoseinu. And all of the nations around us, vayiru, is presumably they saw rather than they were afraid. But how do they translate it here? Archgrounders as they saw. That's reasonable. They all saw it. Vayiplum ma'od be'inehem. And they fell in their own eyes. The usual way to read this is, they fell in their own eyes, meaning they saw their status fall. They said, we are now diminished. There is a view of Ralbag who says, Vayiplu is from Pele. They're shocked. Yeah. Okay. Vayidu ki me'es Elokeinu ne'estam lachazos, and they knew this is from God. The fact that they succeeded in doing this, Mitzudat David says, the fact they did it so quickly, that means that that this is from God. And a very simple read is, look, Jews have been living here for decades and they haven't been successful, they succeeded now, it's from God. Or it's Nehemiah being humble. Right, Nehemiah saying, Debbie's not here to argue this point. They hope you're listening. It's Nehemiah saying, I defer credit to God. Everybody understood. See that God did this. Gam bayamim ahem. Also in those days, marbim chore Yehuda igrosehem holochos al tovia. Chore Yehuda are the nobles of Yehuda, the leaders of Yehuda, are sending a lot of letters to Tovia. And letters are coming from Tovia back to them. Because there were a lot of people in Yehuda who had sworn loyalty to Tovia. Because he was a chatan. He was a son-in-law of Shechaniah ben Arach, who is himself an important figure among the Jews. V'Yehochanan b'no, and his son Yehochanan, the son of Tovia, lakach es bas Meshulam ben Berechia, married the daughter of Meshulam ben Berechia, whose name showed up a couple of times in the building of the wall. So, in other words, he has married into some important Jewish families. Yep, gam tovosav hayu omrim lafanai. They used to say such nice things about him to me. Udvarai hayu motziim lo, and they took my words back to him. Presumably those are not tovosav. They, as we'll see. Igros shalach tovia liyareini, and Tovia sent letters to intimidate me. In other words, as Mitzudat David notes on your sheet in source number 8, building your wall doesn't mean you're safe. Af achar tashlum habinyan. Even after the wall was complete, im kira'u asher nestam me'esa elokim, even though they saw it came from God, al kol ze rabim misarei Yehuda hayushalchim igro del Tovia. Nonetheless, many of the leaders of Yehuda sent letters to Tovia, vayigros asher leTovia hayubaos aleihem, and letters came back from Tovia to them, derech ahava v'chiba, in a manner of love and affection. They're all so lovey-dovey, and Tovia is doing just fine in the community, and my wall can't prevent that. Tovia is well connected. So here's the big question. Sorry? So go back for a second. This is a good segue. Go back to Nehemiah Perek Bet, chapter 2. Where we first met Tovia is in Perek Bet Pasuk Yotet, chapter 2, sentence 19. It is page 1841. Actually, even before that, sorry, sentence Yud, Pasuk Yud, sentence 10, at the top of the page. They're both the same. So here is the introduction. Nehemiah shows up, and Sanballat HaChoroni, V'Tovia HaEved HaAmoni. right? The two of them are very upset to hear about the fact that I am here and that I'm able to and that I'm able to start building.
He was an ally of Sanballat.
He's an ally of Sanballat. He disappeared in the beginning of our chapter when they did the plot to try to lure Nehemiah out of the city, but he's still very much involved. That's who Tovia is. But here's the question. If he is an Eved HaAmoni, and if that means he's an Ammonite slave, what is the nature of his marriage to the daughter of Shechaniah ben Arach? What is this? We know what it is. It is an intermarriage. I thought we got rid of those. Right? Didn't Ezra do this whole campaign to eliminate those? So what's the answer? What?
Not everyone separated or people went back.
So the first answer, and the most simple answer is, you didn't succeed. And in fact, we're going to see that at the end of Nehemiah, we're going to have more issues with intermarriage. So one answer is, Ezra did the best he could, but he didn't succeed, and this is a case of somebody who avoided his decree. That would be one approach. Ralbag points out something that we discussed ages ago, the end of last year. The marriages that Ezra eliminated were marriages between whom and whom?
The woman were from the
non-Jewish women, Jewish men. This is going the other way. So Ralbag says in source number 6, number 9, even though Tovia is a Samaritan loosely if he's from Ammon, lo tihar zachitun, nonetheless Ezra did not purge this marriage, shaya lahem imo, which they had with him, ki benos hayehudim hayu beveso, because he had Jewish women in his house, umashatir Ezra who ana shema nochriot shokhu hayehudim, and Ezra did the other way, right? We explained at the time the rationale for saying that Ezra only does marriages one way, right? We said because when the Jewish women marry the non-Jewish men, they become part of the non-Jewish man's household, and Ezra has no sway. His jurisdiction ends there, and therefore he's not able to do anything about those marriages. And that's a second idea, and again, a fairly straightforward approach. However, there's a third possibility. When we introduced Tovia back in Perek Bet, I mentioned to you that Zakheim actually believes that Tovia is Jewish. And at the time I said, I don't know where he got that idea. The pasuk says he's an Eved Ammoni. Why would you assume that he's a Jew? In fact, if you jump number 10, don't look at number 10 yet, look at number 11. The Gemara in Kiddushin is usually understood to say that he's not Jewish. Way back in the beginning of Sefer Ezra, we talked about who came out of exile. And we had that long name list, right, in Ezra Perek Bet, that told us who comes back with Zerubbabel. And we said there were 10 different lineages. And the Gemara tries to show how you can tell in the text that there are people of different lineages, and one of those is Mamzeri. How do you know that there were Mamzerim? People who lacked halachic legitimacy. How do you know that there were Mamzerim? In Alan, source 11, Dichsev, and they quote, they mentioned Tovia, the Ammonite slave. And the pasuk says, "Ki rabim b'Yehuda balei shvu'alau, ki chasan hu l'shchaniah ben Arach, Yochanan ben Olakachas bat Mishlam ben Brechia." That he's a son-in-law of Shchaniah ben Arach. That his son has married the daughter of Mishulam ben Brechia. That's our pasuk that we just read. Says the Gemara, "Kasavar ove kochavim ve'eved abba bas Yisrael havlad mamzer." This is within the view that if a non-Jew or an Eved lives with a Jewish woman, the child is a mamzer. We don't paskin this way, right? As a matter of halacha, a child born out of an intermarriage is not a mamzer. But that's the view in the Gemara that says that there were mamzerim. See it in this pasuk because Tovia is marrying in. Now, this Gemara seems to assume that Tovia is not Jewish. Right, and that's been our working assumption all along, except for, again, the Zakheim claim. But then you look at Rashi in source number 10 here. And Rashi comments on the letters sent El Tovia, the letters that are sent to Tovia, Yisrael Rasha Haya. He was a wicked Yisrael.
And where does he get that?
Right, so I know how he knows he's wicked.
Right.
right? Because he's plotting against Nehemiah. Nehemiah's a good guy. If you're against Nehemiah, you're a problem. But how does he know that he's Jewish? And he's ignoring the Gemara in Kiddushin. As a matter of fact, in various editions of Rashi, after he says he saw Rosh Ahaya, you find in parentheses, see Kiddushin Ayin Amud Aleph, and we don't know why Rashi did this. So there are three approaches that I have for where Rashi does this. First of all, I found a very interesting paper in source number 12. I give you the reference and the link, who argues that parts of Rashi on Ezra and Nehemiah are actually not Rashi. There's another Rishon about a century later than Rashi, who it is alleged is the author of this commentary or part of the commentary on Ezra and Nehemiah. One of the reasons why is because there are some things that appear in Rashi, some comments here in Rashi on Ezra and Nehemiah, which don't appear in Rashi anywhere else in Tanakh, but do appear. I'm blanking now whether it's Rabbi Yosef Kara, he thinks it is, or there was somebody else, Rabbi Shmuel, someone I was not familiar with, Shmuel mi Sinut, or something along those lines, who had. But there are certain catchphrases that Rashi doesn't have that appear elsewhere. So there is a school of thought, actually starts with Abraham Geiger, he's the first one to make this claim, that this isn't Rashi. And therefore, that takes a little bit of the pressure off. In other words, Rashi doesn't go against the Gemara. We had one other case where Rashi went against the Gemara that we talked about when they brought the Karban Asham for their intermarriages, and the Gemara said it's because of the Shifcha Harufa, and Rashi said it was Harasham. We discussed back then why it is that Rashi veers from it. So maybe the answer is this isn't really Rashi talking. Maybe. The second approach would be to say that you could read the Gemara in number 11 to say he was an Eved Kenani. He was a non-Jew who had become an Eved. But it would not be considered an intermarriage in the event that, you know, Ezra's dissolving intermarriages, this would not be considered an intermarriage. It's a very difficult argument to make. It's labeling him an Eved Kenani, and therefore he doesn't need to be separated because an Eved Kenani is quasi-Jewish. It's a hard argument to make. I'll tell you what I think Rashi is doing. I think Rashi is forced into this because Rashi doesn't accept that Ezra was unsuccessful. In other words, Rashi's view is Ezra got rid of intermarriages. Whatever's going to happen at the end of Nehemiah is years and years later. But Ezra succeeded in dissolving the inappropriate marriages, and therefore if Tovia has this marriage, Tovia must be Jewish. I think that's what's driving Rashi. And so he's willing to say that he's Jewish, and that's what Zakheim latches onto. He doesn't tell you that that's where he's getting it, but I think that's what Zakheim latches onto is this comment in Rashi here. So here you have Tovia, who is either a non-Jew who is married very well into the Jewish community, or a Jew who is very connected within the Jewish community, but is hostile. And people are communicating with him. And they're telling Nehemiah good things about him. And they're bringing Nehemiah's words back to they're bringing Nehemiah's words back to Tovia. If you take a look at Mitzvot David in source number 14, I'm going to come back to number 13. But take a look first at number 14, Mitzudat David. He says, Dvarim tovim anim tzavet tovia hayu omrim lefanai leman yaknitu osi. They would tell me good things about Tovia in order to get me upset. I think the other reason that we floated at one point for saying that Tovia was Jewish was because of his name. Tovia is such a Jewish name. Yeah. You know? Not just good, but that you use the Yud Hey name of God as part of the as part of it. I think we suggested when we first read about him that maybe that's why we would say he's Jewish. In any case, going back to this, the Mitzvot David says they tell me about how good he is just in order to get me upset that he has allies. Right? I'm going to hear people saying good things about him. I'm going to get scared. I'm going to get upset. But they also take Nehemiah's words back to him. So take a look at source number 13, where Malbim says, Shayu Amrom Omrim Tovos Alav, they said good things about him. Vechziku Oso Leish Tov Yashar, they said, yeah, this is a good man. Vayidechein Ayu Motziim Gamkein Divrei Nehemiah Vesodosav El Toviyah. They also, as a result, gave him all my secrets, all my maneuvers they were telling Toviah. And he had Jews who were spying on his behalf. Not only that, Mitzudat David adds that they told him my insults. All the nasty things I had to say about him, they would communicate back to Toviah, and therefore he wrote intimidating letters to me. So in other words, what Nehemiah is saying is, we're not out of the woods. The fact that we have a wall is great, but Tobiah has infiltrated our community, and therefore we are still vulnerable. Now, Malbim reads this not as a self-contained story, but as a lead-in to the next parak. Take a look at source number 15. The beginning of the next parak is going to talk about Nehemiah establishing guards for the walls of the city. So if you take a look at 15, the Malbim says, Hi hakdama el mashe yomar b'siman haba. This is an introduction to what's coming next. Shemana es achiv al chomot Yerushalayim, that he appointed his allies or brethren over the walls of Jerusalem. V'tzival ishmor ha'ir gam achar kach. And he said, I know we have a wall, we still need to guard the city. Granted that the fear of God has affected everybody around us, nonetheless, there are still Jews who are causes of harm. There are still pitfalls among the Jews themselves, and therefore you need guards. So the theme of this parak, and what we have, you know, from our 2.5 weeks or so that we spent on this parak, is that the plots have become personal to Nehemiah. They're now attacking him personally. And the plots persist even after the wall is complete. Start on Parag Zion? Good. Okay, let's start on Parag Zion. Having a wall doesn't mean you're safe. So what do? You set up guards. So Parag Zion, Pasuk Aleph, page 1851, motoring along. Vayhi kasher nimnesa chomah. And it was when the wall was complete. Va amid hadilasos, and I had set up the doors. Va yipakdu ha-shoarim va-ham-shoarim va-halaviyim. So the shoarim, the gatekeepers, not gatekeepers of the Beis Hamikdash, right? Gatekeepers, I'm sorry, no, not gatekeepers of this wall, gatekeepers of the Beis Hamikdash are the shoarim. So the gatekeepers of the Beis Hamikdash are set up, they're commissioned. The Misharim, the singers, the Levim, they're all commissioned. Va'atzaves Hanani Achi. And I instructed my brother Hanani, who we saw in the beginning of the book. He was the one who brought the message to Nehemiah in the first place. We noted that some people think he's an actual brother, but the commentators tend to assume he's simply an ally. Ves Hanania Sar HaBira, as well as Hanania, the head of the fortress, the building, the capital, whatever you want to use for your translation of the word Bira. Sorry?
The citadel.
The citadel. Okay, that's a nice word. Al Yerushalayim, I put them in charge of the city. Kihu ki'ish emes, v'yareyas ha'elokim me'rabim. That's a hard phrase to translate. Because he, meaning Hananiah, the one who's not my ally, but I picked him anyway, was ki'ish emes. He was like a person of truth. The commentators generally say it means just that he really was a person of truth. They don't get too hung up on the chaf. And v'yareyas elokim me'rabim. What in the world does that mean? So the article translates it, he has been God-fearing for a very long time. Me'rabim is like miyamim rabim. You know, for a long time he has been a God-fearing person. I'm going to come back to that phrase. But that's making a note for myself there. Okay. But that's who he commissions to be in charge of the wall. And he says, Va'omar lahem, and I said to them, Lo yipaschu sharei Yerushalayim ad chom ha-shemesh. I don't want the gates of Yerushalayim opened until the heat of the day. What time is the heat of the day?
Noon.
Noon, midday. Walls of Jerusalem are closed in the mornings. It's like when I first got to Israel, and the stores are all closed from whatever it was, 1 to 3 o'clock. Back in the day, everything was closed from 1 to 3 o'clock. This is a siesta. And I had no idea what to make of this. This kid coming from the U.S. What do you mean the store's just closed? Yeah, no, this is the way it works. Jerusalem is closed for business in the morning. It'll be open at noon. That's what he said. Ve'ad heimondim yagifu ad lasos ve'achozu. And while the guards are still standing there, shut the doors. Right? Close them tight. Don't let the doors... Don't let the doors be open unless you have guards there. As long as you have guards, you keep them open. When the guards are ready to leave, lock them. V'hameid mishmaros yoshvei Yerushalayim ish b'mishmaro v'ish neged beiso. And set up shifts from the dwellers of the city, residents of the city. Each one will have a shift. Each one will guard opposite his home. Right? That local advantage that we talked about with the builders remains here as well. Okay. What here is strange in these three psukim? There are a couple of things that should catch your eye. Well, no, that's what you do in the course of the day.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
While they are standing there,
I mean, first of all, why are you opening the doors at midday? Why are you not opening the doors at 10 a.m.? Why are you not opening the doors at sunrise? Why are you opening the doors at midday, right?
These are the gates of the city, right?
These are the gates of the city, correct. Correct.
So you're afraid it was going to come in?
Well, if you're afraid it was going to come in, why am I opening the doors ever? Right, well, what's his preference for the afternoon? Which is going to sleep in?
He's clearly distressful.
Presumably.
He seems to be distressed.
Right, I mean, you have to read this as you're afraid of attack in the mornings. You're afraid of being surprised. That's for sure you have to read it. But we're going to see some significance to this beyond that. But what about Pasuk Aleph?
The question is, he's established the gatekeepers, the singers, and Levine. Where are the Kohanim?
Where are the Kohanim is one question, right? But also, why are you doing this now? You've had a Beis HaMikdash for decades. Right? You've had a Beis HaMikdash for decades. And we, in our initial Aliyah with Zerubbabel, we had gatekeepers and singers and whatnot. Why are they being assigned to this role now? What does it have to do with establishing the walls of Yerushalayim? What's the connection? It doesn't seem to fit.
Are these ones he trusts versus ones he doesn't trust?
So could be that this is an issue of trust. So let's go through this. Ralbag says, first of all, that even though there's a vav v'halevi'im, the way to read the line is that the Levi'im were assigned as gatekeepers and singers. That's the way that he reads the line. But in terms of why you're doing this now, I have three different explanations. First, the Zakheim approach in source number 17. It sounds really good until you think about it. He says, Nehemiah was faced with a dilemma. He could not rely on the loyalty of the priests, since many of their leaders had ties by marriage to his opponents. Yet he could not displace the priests. His religious commitment forced him to support priestly activities in the temple. His solution was quite clever. Without derogating from the duties of the priests, he diluted their power by lifting the Levites from the underclass and giving them a stake in the temple apparatus. The Levites had already indicated their willingness to align themselves with Nehemiah when they contributed to his efforts to repair the wall. In particular, in addition to restoring their traditional role as singers in the temple services and guardians of the temple entrances, he organized them into a new security force. The Levites were not only armed, but for the first time functioned as state auxiliaries with all the power and prestige that such positions entailed. It's a political maneuver. That's why it's happening now. When he seeks to reduce the power of the priests, he's worried about their alliances with Tovia, and he elevates the Levium. Yeah, Ralph.
Is that to assume that the priests were there before, and the Levites are new, because
they were brought in by the
king. Right, so this is a real problem. This doesn't fit. I mean, it's a great idea, but it doesn't fit. First of all, it's true that we've seen problems with Kohanim. Right, you had the intermarriages where in Ezra chapter 10 it mentioned the Kohanim were intermarrying, and the Kohanim were in the group that he didn't trust. When Nehemiah showed up and he did his reconnaissance, he said, "I didn't tell the nobles what I was doing. I didn't tell the Kohanim what I was doing." And we even saw in Perek Hey, remember the oath when he was having them get rid of their loans, and he said, "I made the Kohanim swear," which some took to mean the Kohanim had also been extending these loans. However, Kohanim worked on the wall also. If you go back to chapter 3, you will find at least three references to Kohanim working on the wall. And you only find one reference in chapter 3 to Leviim working on the wall. So don't tell me the Leviim earned their keep or earned his trust by working on the wall. The Kohanim worked on the wall more than Leviim did. Further, we have no evidence that the Kohanim were the ones doing these jobs until now. Just the opposite. Again, under Zerubbabel, the Leviim did these jobs. So I don't buy what he's saying. I have a couple of other approaches. Ralph, you going to?
I just wondered whether marrying a Shomer Nim was considered intermarriage.
Yes. Yeah, it was viewed intermarriage. That was the principal case of intermarriage that they had.
I just want to see.
Okay, we're at 229. So, sorry? Yeah, all right. I'll tell you the two ideas, and then we'll come back to it next time. We'll read it next time, but they don't want to leave you in suspense. The Malbim says that they were only appointed now because everybody was busy with the wall until now. So now they get appointed. Ralbag says there were extra new positions that he had to create, and that's what he did at this point. We'll see the evidence for both of these, God willing, next week. But what we have at this point is the ongoing fear and Nehemiah's ability to manage the situation and deal with each crisis as it comes up. Chapter 7 is going to bring to a close the discussion of these practicalities for now. And then in chapter 8, we move back to the religious issues that the nation is dealing with. Chapter 7 is going to have a major census, but I don't think we're going to actually read out every word of the census because we saw most of it already back in Ezra chapter 2. More to discuss then. Thank you very much.